So it's a hot Wednesday afternoon last week. I jump outside, head out to the mailbox, open the little door, and take out three padded envelopes of, you know, various shapes and sizes, come inside, throw them down on the desk, scattered and pretty much ignored. I come back later and decide to open one. Thankfully, the contents are light, which is not common these days. I pull it out, I've got a CD and a one-pager of biographical information. But then I start to read it. When was the last time you bought a solid rock record that you never wanted to end? One that had such power, melody, and consistently good songwriting that you wanted to leave the whole album on repeat? Or even an album where each song is so good that you could never hit the skip button? Ladies and gentlemen, please meet 1986. Yeah, right. I start cracking up, right? How many bands put this on their bios? Yes, oh, we just made the newest, great, the best indie album of the decade. But then I listened to it, and it floored me. It stunned me. I immediately wanted to listen to it again. I wanted to know everything about 1986. Everything. So, this episode, Insomnia Radio 92, we're going to focus on the band 1986. Got a little bit of an interview to play for you guys, and we're going to take a peek at four or five of the songs from 1986's debut long player, Nihilism Is Nothing to Worry About, to start proving my point that this actually is one of the better indie rock albums out there that you will never want to end. This is the opening track on the disc, Laughing.
Social Security. That you're wrong just this time, 'cause I can't tell you've gone too far. Your way past the line, 'cause I have bowed down to you 10 times before. And I can't afford to settle a pointless score. Times have come to pass, so just relax in the comfort of your mind. The grin is thrown across your face, is condescending for its time to make sense of what you've tried.
Recently, I was fortunate enough to get in touch with Giorgio Angelini, the band's chief songwriter, founder, and vocalist, and get him to answer a bunch of questions. So he rounded up the rest of the band, and they all got together, sat down, and answered all of these questions. The first one I asked him, what was your first record?
Well, Colly, our drummer, apparently his first record was Technotronic, and you know, I can't say it wasn't one of my first ones. I do certainly remember the tape being in my tape deck, but I'm pretty sure I stole it from my brother. As far as my first record purchase, I really wish it could be a lot cooler, but I think it was my 10th birthday, and I asked my best friend at the time's mom to buy me... Oh, wait, no, we're chiming in now. Oh, Cully knows what it is now. He was just lying before. What is it?
Young Guns 2.
Young Guns 2. Oh, that's pretty solid. I like that. But we rocked them all! That's all you need to know. They rocked them all. But, I was asking for my birthday. I was asking for a Megadeth Rust in Peace. And my friend's mom came back from the record store with a different record because the salesman told her that it was inappropriate for a 10-year-old to be listening to Megadeth. So he recommended Sonic Youth Dirty. So there I was, 10 years old, with Sonic Youth record in my hands. And I'd really like to say that I popped it in and just totally revolutionized what I thought about music. But I really hated it and listened to it for about 14 seconds. And I think it collected dust for about 10 years until I listened to it again when I was 19 or 20 and somewhat got it. Now I really love it. What about you, Drew?
I'd say that my first record experience was along similar lines. I was at the record store during a period of my life where I was intent on pissing off my parents, and probably the most grotesque-looking cover I could find was a band called Cannibal Corpse. I had the same experience virtually as Giorgio did. I popped it in and for about the first 14 seconds dropped my jaw and allowed myself to be appalled before removing it. Unfortunately, I can't say I ever came back to good old Cannibal Corpse, but the next record I got after that was Weird Al Yankovic, Smells Like Nirvana, followed by Nirvana Nevermind, and there you go. That was my introduction into my own flavor of rock and roll.
So Weird Al got you into Nirvana.
That's right. Weird Al got me into Nirvana, got me to see MC Hammer for what he really was at the time.
Yeah.
Weird Al did a lot for me. Really changed my life.
And just to be fair to everyone out there, my first record was Michael Jackson's Thriller on vinyl. So there you have it. Now, one of the things that really got me hooked into the whole mythology behind the band and their roots was a story about an audition. Giorgio had auditioned for the role of Rushmore, and you could say that it changed his life. Here's the story.
Yeah, that was a weird situation, actually. Rushmore was actually being filmed at my high school, and they had an open casting call. And like a lot of my friends, I went to go try out because we all thought we were going to be big Hollywood stars. And when I didn't get the call back immediately, I ended up deciding to go on this Young Life ski trip, which is, you know, a way to get closer to Jesus. But me and most of my friends that were going were really just going to chase after... Well, a few of us were going after chase after this one girl. So I ended up going not so much for the Jesus, but for the lady. And when I came back from the Young Life ski trip, having not found God or this woman, much to my surprise, I found out on my answering machine that I had indeed gotten a part in Rushmore. But I indeed was too late. So my friend ended up taking the part and went to go on to MTV Music Awards. And anyway, yeah, so did the girl change my fate? I don't know. Maybe it's for the better, because I probably would have made a pretty crappy actor.
Now, these kind of situations actually create the backdrop for a lot of the songwriting on this album. And it extends even farther than that, down to the search for the band itself, you know, creating the band that would be 1986. For example, they were looking for a bassist, and he actually just ran into his old friend Drew on a bus, who he had not seen for 10 years. So the band definitely, I think, has fate working in their favor. Let's check out another song from the album. This is Better When You're Stoned, right here on Insomnia Radio.
Better, but they don't.
When I was cruising around for a little bit more information on the band, I looked at one of their blogs on MySpace and noticed who was producing one of their forthcoming songs. And it got me really personally excited and excited for the band once I started digging around to discover who exactly John Agnello is. John Agnello is a legendary producer. This guy has worked with, where do I start? Pfeiffer Fighting, Patti Smith, Dar Williams, Not a Surf, Dinosaur Jr., The Screaming Trees, Sonic Youth, Buffalo Tom, Alice Cooper, Jimmy Eat World. The list just goes on and on and on. And to have him on board for 1986's second album before their first album has even dropped. And by the way, that release date is July 25th, 2006. And I will have information on how to pre-order the disc. The guys are working really hard to get a pre-order system in place before the release of this episode. But anyway, that was just really exciting. And I asked Giorgio to tell me a little bit more about that.
The song Habits, we actually recorded with him a few months back. And yeah, it's a new song that I guess will be included on a record we're already starting to write and record now. I had emailed John like 6 months ago after I had seen Sunvolt play on David Letterman. I knew he'd done their last record, and for whatever reason I just decided at 2 in the morning to email John and send him a sampling of our music, and he ended up saying yes. So we recorded Habits, and I guess we're going to do the next record with him. We're all really excited. He's a badass, to say the very least. Nipples are hard. Hard. Very hard. Milk.
Congratulations, guys. That is cool. Now, something that I have always been personally curious about is how long it takes to record an album. Any album. Especially an album like this that has this kind of quality behind it. You know, you look at, say, Recliner, for example. It took them basically the bulk of a weekend to record both of their recent LPs. A band like Blame Amy, it took them, I think, 6 to 9 months to do it, and they logged over 180 hours. So it's always a question that I'm kind of looking to ask people, and here's what they had to say about it.
It took us about, like, I don't know, a month to do, maybe less. We sort of, the band came together in October of 2004, and I had a record's worth of songs in mind, and we rehearsed them, and Mark came in and sort of whipped the songs into shape, kind of trimming the fat a bit, and we went in the studio in Austin at Cacophony Studios, great little studio, and plug, and we cut the album about a month, and then Tom came in town from New York to mix the record in March, and that took about a week. So yeah, about 5 weeks. Good times were had. It really wasn't, it's a pretty stress-free recording situation. You know, Mark was an interesting fellow to record the album with. He always referred to bad takes as clams, which I believe is a reference to Muscle Shoals recording engineer, whose name I forgot, but I think it went something along the lines of, "There's nothing but clams. You're giving me nothing but clams, baby. Nothing but clams."
Now, who is this mysterious Mark, you might ask? It is Mark Dutron of the Melvins, produced the album and played guitar. Incredible. These guys are, I mean, garnering this much interest from the music industry at large right now. I am very excited for them and very interested to see if this album really does take off. I mean, it's certainly worthy of it. I am a very, very picky individual, as you guys know. For about every song you hear on Insomnia Radio, about 10 didn't make it. And, you know, I can't say it enough. This album is just, it's so solid and so well written, and there's so many little flourishes and touches that just make you want to go back and listen to each song. I'm going to play another one for you before we get into the rest of the interview, which is, by the way, going to focus a lot on kind of the general music industry. you know, how they feel about podcasting. Can an indie band make it without a label? So keep listening. Good times are coming up. But for now, I'm going to play my personal favorite track. This is Mechanical Dreams. This is 1986. See you in a minute.
So turn it back, cause I can't and I won't try to react. Though I'm through with this, society's hiss and the things I can't see that I wanna believe. And they dismiss for ignorance bliss, cause a family tree is a powerful plea. The rich white body's looking fat, walks from his place and sold him the crap. And you, you don't owe me nothing. To run, and she thinks that she knows just what she wants. A mechanical dream is just what it seems, as they fight to try to smother the screams. And I'm sick inside by the things they've tried. And a kid I know, he's been lost with a few, and his parents don't know what else they can do. And you, you don't owe me nothing. I'm not asking for your.
One of the questions that I really wanted to ask them was how they felt about podcasting, because really when you start to think about it, it's been around almost 2 years, but in terms of, you know, the kind of media that it is in the global scheme of things, it's really in its infancy, and so many people and so many bands have never heard the word, don't know how to harness the power of it, and, you know, obviously I feel like it's a force to be reckoned with. And, you know, the people that subscribe to podcasts are typically a lot more dedicated than your, you know, average radio listener or somebody who just hops online to catch an internet radio stream once in a while. And it's also sort of a portal into bigger things. You know, if you look at a lot of bands that I've played or that other podcasters have played, it's kind of been like their entryway into getting some exposure. And I've seen it so many times, they typically go on to bigger and much better things. Maybe you can attribute that to podcasting, maybe not. But I asked Giorgio how he felt about it, and the answer is short and sweet.
There's no doubt that podcasting and everything that's going on the internet, the blogging, it all really helps, especially because it gives every band pretty much equal access to the market. And in the case of a lot of bands right now, you know, like Tapes and Tapes and your Clap Your Hands stuff, it's all very organic. And anything to get the power away from megalopolies like Clear Channel is cool by me.
Now, the next question I asked was a little bit more involved. You know, with tools like MySpace, like podcasting, like very, very cheap digital distribution websites like TuneCore, etc., do you feel that an indie band or any band needs a label to succeed?
Do indie bands need a label to succeed? I mean, in a lot of ways, no, but I think ultimately it always just boils down to how smart of an individual you are, because it doesn't matter how many promotional tools there are available to a band. If you're not, you know, business oriented, or at least a smart individual willing to learn how this stuff works, then no. And there's certainly no shortage of idiots in the music business on the band side, that's for sure. Definitely for sure on the label side, of course, too. But I mean, it's slightly easier for me, or at least more natural, because I guess my other job is actually in the music business. I'm also a music manager. I work with the Comas and friends of Dean Martinez and a girl named Dawn Landis. So, you know, I'm pretty well into the music business and sort of understanding of how the inner workings work. But I mean, still, it's really confusing, and there's lots of ins and outs of distribution and publishing of songs. There's so many different ways for bands to get taken advantage of. If you're not on your game, it's really easy to get lost in the minutiae, you know. And there's just so many factors that go into what makes a successful record. I mean, ultimately, it's obviously the music, but I've heard so many great bands that release records that never get press, or do get press but never sell records. It's just, it's sort of has to be a magical combination of so many different factors. So can bands be successful without a label? Sure, but I think it's always been the case. And I think bands like Superchunk 15 years ago, 20 years ago, showed the same thing. I mean, Merge Records is based off of a band who refused to sign to a record label. So I think it just boils down to personal will. Obviously, it's great having these new tools available to us. So smart bands with this kind of internet technology in front of them, yeah, I think so. It's good.
Now, with all that said, there is a big, big line in the sand. On one side is using all of the tools that a band has at their disposal to be a success, but what about being a financial success? It has got to be almost impossible for a band to take the leap of faith, you know, from here I am standing on one side, I'm making music, it's good, it's being received well, but how can it be my new day job? Two artists that you know fairly well from this show, Chance and Blame Amy, are both taking that leap in the near future, essentially quitting their jobs, letting everything go, and going out on the road and trying to make it. I asked 1986 if, at this point, being in the band is self-sustaining or not.
is a band self-sustaining? I'll put it this way. I think our last tour to the West Coast grossed $83. Yeah, we played to like 53 people. So, good ratios there.
We're doing well.
And, no, it is really hard, and there's just a lot of bands out there, and a lot for people to sort through. 20 years ago, there was 6,000 releases, and last year, there was 36,000 releases. And I don't know, I think that there's just too much music out there, and it can't help but clog up the system for truly brilliant bands like ours. But, JK, dude, JK. But no, there's a lot of bands out there, and it's hard, and obviously the gas prices make things difficult, but we're looking to buy a diesel van and run that stuff on biodiesel. We got our friends at Apollo Sunshine do it, and told me it cost them like $100 to cross the country, so that definitely alleviates the problem. But there's not much of juggling of tours really either. We don't get an onslaught of tour offers, really, but we are touring with Dressy Bessie next month, and this is our first release, so hopefully, you know, if there's people out there that like our Rizzoc, they can bring it. We're open for touring. We're open for business.
Someone said it. They told me, take it somewhere else. Don't take it literally. No one hears, and no one sees to care, and no one sees to care.
That was 1986 with their song I Know from the forthcoming album Nihilism Is Nothing to Worry About, which is going to be released all over the place on July 25th. And they are taking pre-orders right now, so check the website insomniaradio.net to learn how to do that. And, you know, what's interesting is as I was trying to find out a little bit more about these guys, digging around MySpace, things like that, I came to find out that Cully and Drew live in Austin, Texas, and Giorgio had moved to New York. So it kind of begged the question, are you all moving to New York, and why?
I guess the move was inspired by me. I've been up in New York by myself. I mean, I guess 9 million other people, but by myself, band speaking, for the past year, coming back and forth between Austin and New York, and the other two guys in the band, Drew and Cully, flying up to New York for shows. So it's been difficult, but it's tried the conviction of the band, and I think we're stronger for it. And now we're uniting again, like the Thundercats or something. Right, Drew?
That's right, Giorgio. You know, I think we've really, Cully and I have really been sold on New York as well. It's just such a fantastic place, and there's so much going on there. We'll always be Texas boys at heart, of course, but it's time to move on out to the East Coast and hit up the music scene there. We're looking forward to it.
Now, if you guys get this in time, they're going to be in Austin, Texas at Emo's June 23rd. And then the next show is going to be at Piano's in New York City, July 13th. July 14th, they'll be in New York with Dressy Bessie, as well as July 16th in Washington, D.C. with Dressy Bessie. And then coming up later in July, July 27th, their record release show in New York City at Piano's. If you want to get all these tour dates, go to myspace.com/1986music. For a few tracks and a little bit of blogging and their entire tour schedule. So there's one last question I wanted to ask the guys in 1986, and that is how well the album has been received thus far in their local scene.
Well, we did sort of like a mini Austin release about a year ago. And we got a really great review in the Chronicle, the Austin Chronicle there, so that was great. And we've always sold well at shows, and MySpace has been really great for us too. Definitely the reactions in New York have been really phenomenal, and a lot of people have been offering to help out with this release, since we're releasing it ourselves. And we've got a really great group of people sort of acting as the infrastructure for what's essentially our record label, Palatine Records. So we actually have professionals who know what they're doing helping us release this record, which is always great. And so, yeah, I mean, I really couldn't ask for anything more, being an unsigned artist, essentially. And with the response we're getting, it's pretty flattering, and I hope it continues.
And definitely, I do too. You guys, do what you can. If you like what you've heard, go support the band. Pre-order the album. It'll be in your hands just after July 25th. Go check them out on tour if you're in Austin or New York City. Hey, send them a love letter, whatever. The band is 1986. Once again, the album is Nihilism Is Nothing to Worry About. You can find them online at myspace.com/1986music. And I want to give a huge, huge thank you to all the guys in the band, Mark, Drew, and Cully, for helping out and making this interview a reality. As you guys know, I'm not real prolific with interviews, although I would like to change that. And this is a good starting point. So some other thank yous go out to Becky Yar at Yar PR, who sent me the album in the first place, and made sure that it graced my eardrums. And also to the entire Insomnia Radio family for all of their recent support. And also to Fender Girl at the Indie Music Project, who is just going crazy finding a whole lot of great music out there, undiscovered and unsigned, and just waiting to be listened to by all kinds of music fans out there. And lastly, to you guys for staying with Insomnia Radio and for all your emails, all your encouragement. And hey, do me a favor, guys. Tell one person about the show. Just one person. If each of you tell one person, hey, subscribe in iTunes, hey, burn them a disc, whatever, then we could double the amount of people that are hearing all this great music. So if you go do that for me, I would so much appreciate it, guys. Thank you, thank you, thank you. You guys are awesome. Now I'm going to take you out with our last song for episode 92. This is 1986 with Narcotic. This has been a production of Insomnia Radio and Indie Music Project. Check out our sites at insomniaradio.net and indiemusicproject.com.